aided the American economy to get a jump on the world in moving toward more fuel-efficient vehicles and renewable energy, which would have reduced our exposure to the massive oil price spike in 2008. Instead, he summoned the nation for a massive tax cut, simultaneously making us more dependent on China to finance our deficit and on Saudi Arabia to fill up our gas tanks. By the end of his time in office, George W. Bush found himself having to travel to Saudi Arabia with the express purpose of begging King Abdullah to give us a little relief on gasoline prices. I guess there was some justice in that. When you, the president, after 9/11, tell the country to go shopping instead of buckling down to break our addiction to oil, it ends with you, the president, shopping the world for discount gasoline. All in all, this post-9/11 performance was one of the greatest squandered opportunities for American nation-building in our history. In many ways, then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's answer to the soldier who asked him why he and his comrades were sent to battle in Iraq without proper equipment, "You go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time," summarized in a few words where we've come to today as a country. We've decided that we'll march into the future with the government we've got, not the one we want to have or wish to have or need to have. But we cannot just march into the future with the government we've got, because, as the French poet Paul Valéry famously said, "The trouble with our times is that the future is not what it used to be." The age we are entering is at once much more dangerous than it looks, and much more opportune than it looks. To thrive in this age, America will have to be at its best. I am convinced that the public is ready. They're ahead of the politicians. In August 2007, I went to Iraq as an embedded reporter with the then Central Command Chief, Admiral William Fallon. At one point, we visited the American Field Hospital in Balad in central Iraq. The full madness that is Iraq was on display there. U.S. soldiers with shrapnel wounds from suicide bombers, insurgents with gunshots to the stomach, and a bandaged 2-month-old baby girl with wounds from an insurgent-planted IED. At one point, Admiral Fallon chatted with the hospital staff, who were all there on overlapping rotations, 30 days, 60 days, 180 days. He asked how they coordinated everyone's coming and going. A voice from the back, a nurse, piped up, "We're all on the same team, sir." I looked around the room. I saw African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, Caucasian Americans, the whole melting pot that is America, working together. Half were women, including mothers who had left behind their families and kids for 6 months or a year to serve in Iraq. I walked away shaking my head, thinking, what have we done to deserve such good people? I don't know the answer, but I do know this. They deserve a government and a national agenda equal to their dedication and idealism. If this many Americans were ready to enlist for nation-building in Iraq, imagine how many would enlist in nation-building at home, in the chance to revive and reinvigorate America so that it realizes its full potential. They deserve that chance. They deserve something more on the other side of the metal detector, an America united and propelled by a common purpose, not a common enemy. And that brings me back to Code Green. The hallmark of those companies and countries that continually thrive is that they continually reinvent themselves, noted David Rothkopf, an energy expert and visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment. We reinvented ourselves as a continental industrial power in the 19th century, and we reinvented ourselves as a global industrial power in the 20th century, and then as a global information society in the 21st century. Now we have to, for our own sake and the world's, reinvent ourselves one more time. Making America the world's greenest country is not a selfless act of charity or naive moral indulgence. It is now a core national security and economic interest. Green is not simply a new form of generating electric power, added Rothkopf. It is a new form of generating national power, period. Let me repeat that. Green is not simply a new form of generating electric power. It is a new form of generating national power, period. It is not just about lighting up our house. It is about lighting up our future. Just go through this mental exercise. What kind of America would you like to see? An America that is addicted to oil and thereby fueling the worst autocracies in the world, or a green America that is building scalable alternatives to crude oil and thereby freeing ourselves from the grip of countries who have drawn a bullseye on our back and whose values we oppose? What kind of America would you like to see? An America that is steadily outsourcing more and more blue-collar, labor-intensive manufacturing jobs to China, or a green America that is building more and more knowledge-intensive, green-collar technology jobs for making green buildings, vehicles, and power sources, which are more difficult to outsource and will have to be the industry of the future as fossil fuel energy supplies dwindle and world population grows? What kind of America would you like to see? An America with more and more urban sprawl, devouring more and more open lands? Or a green America where cities start to grow upward rather than outward, where mass transit becomes the norm rather than mass traffic jams, and where the only new buildings are green buildings? What kind of America would you like to see? An America where government relaxes energy and efficiency standards on cars, buildings, and appliances, prompting our industries to get innovation lazy? Or a green America where the U.S. government imposes steadily higher efficiency standards, forcing a constant flow of new thinking around materials, power systems, and energy software, making us the most energy-productive country in the world? What kind of America would you like to see? An America where there is no big national goal, or a green America where inventing a source of abundant, clean, reliable, cheap electrons which could enable the whole planet to grow in a way that doesn't destroy its remaining natural habitats becomes the goal of this generation, inspiring young people to go into math, science, biology, physics, and nanotechnology? What kind of America would you like to see? An America that is spotlighted as the last holdout at international environmental conferences, earning the world's contempt? Or a green America that is seen as the country most committed, by example, to preserving our environment and the species that inhabit it, earning the world's respect? There is a Chinese proverb that says, "When the wind changes direction, there are those who build walls and those who build windmills." What will we do? Build more American walls around our embassies, walls around the headquarters of our companies, tariffs around our products, trade barriers to wall off our economy, legal walls to protect our automakers, electronic walls to protect our borders, military walls to isolate us from our allies and further motivate our enemies, and visa walls to prevent visitors from entering our country, living the American dream, melting in with our people, and enriching our culture? Or will we build windmills that we will use ourselves and export to others in every shape, color, flavor, and style? Yes, the wind has changed direction. The era we are heading into will be an era in which our lives, our ecosystems, our economies, and our political choices will be constrained if we do not find a cleaner way to power our future and a better way to protect our natural world. So I say we build windmills. I say we lead. In such an America, birds will surely fly again, in every sense of that term. Our air will be cleaner, our environment will be healthier, our young people will see their idealism mirrored in their own government, and our industries will have more tools to do good for themselves and the planet at the same time. That is also an America that will have its identity back, not to mention its self-confidence, because it will again be leading the world on the most important strategic mission and values issue of the day. We have been living for far too long on borrowed time and borrowed dimes. We need to get back to work on our country and on our planet. The hour is late. The stakes couldn't be higher. The project couldn't be harder. The payoff couldn't be greater. The rest of the audio program is how to make it happen. Chapter 2. Today's date, 1 ECE. Today's weather, hot, flat, and crowded. So what is this new era we're heading into that makes America's adopting a code green strategy so necessary, so relevant, and so opportune? The short answer is that we're entering the energy climate era. In The World is Flat, 2005, I argued that the technological revolution that was leveling the global economic playing field and enabling so many more people around the world to compete, connect, and collaborate was ushering in a new phase of globalization that would have a huge impact on economics, politics, and military and social affairs. The more I travel, the more I see the effects of the flattening of the world. But events of the past few years have made it clear to me that two other enormously powerful forces are impacting our planet in fundamental ways: global warming and soaring global population growth. As I absorbed these into my own analysis, it became obvious that it's actually the convergence of global warming, global flattening, and global crowding that is the most important dynamic shaping the world we live in today. My shorthand for this convergence is the title of this audio program, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, and my shorthand for the historical epoch this convergence is giving birth to is the energy climate era. This program focuses on five key problems that a hot, flat, and crowded world is dramatically intensifying. They are the growing demand for ever scarcer energy supplies and natural resources, a massive transfer of wealth to oil-rich countries and their petro-dictators, disruptive climate change, energy poverty, which is sharply dividing the world into electricity haves and electricity have-nots, and rapidly accelerating biodiversity loss as plants and animals go extinct at record rates. I believe that these problems and how we manage them will define the energy climate era. Because they are no ordinary problems, any one of them, if not managed properly, could cause sweeping, non-linear, irreversible disruptions that might affect multiple generations. If we are going to solve these problems, we will need new tools, new infrastructure, new ways of thinking, and new ways of collaborating with others. The stuff of great new industries and scientific breakthroughs, and the stuff that propels one nation forward and leaves another behind. So we had better understand this new era we're heading into. The operative word here is new. We need to stop thinking of ourselves as post-something. Post-colonial, post-war, post-Cold War, post-post-Cold War. Those eras are meaningless today. Wash them out of your mind. They explain nothing about where we are now. I don't think we're post anything anymore. I think we're pre something totally new, said David Rothkopf, the energy consultant. And the thing we are entering is the energy climate era. I think we're at one of those bright line moments in history when things could change in ways that we can hardly imagine and across a very broad number of areas simultaneously, added Rothkopf. We have seen such moments before, the democratic revolutions of the Enlightenment or the Industrial Revolution, and in our own time, the information technology revolution. One thing they all had in common is that when things started changing, people could not initially grasp their full significance. Another thing they had in common was that with all these great changes came great challenges. And it was rising to those challenges that defined the new eras, drove progress, gave birth to new institutions, and separated the winners from the losers. Indeed, the countries that inspired and invented the big solutions to the big problems of the past led the eras that followed. And those countries that failed to adapt fell by the wayside. In this new energy climate era, America has to make sure it is among the former. Let's start by examining the engine of this new era, this convergence of hot, flat, and crowded, beginning with crowded. Here is a statistic I find staggering. I was born on July 20th, 1953. If you go to the website infoplease.com and put in your date of birth, you can find out roughly how many people were living on planet Earth the day you were born. I did that, and the number that popped up was 2.681 billion. God willing, if I keep biking and eating yogurt, I might live to be 100. By 2053, the United Nations projects that there will be more than 9 billion people on the planet, thanks to improvements in healthcare, disease eradication, and economic development. That means that in my lifetime, the world's population will have more than tripled, and roughly as many people will be born between now and 2053 as were here when I was born. Specifically, the United Nations Population Division issued a report, March 13, 2007, stating that the world population will likely increase by 2.5 billion over the next 43 years, passing from the current 6.7 billion to 9.2 billion in 2050. This increase is equivalent to the total size of the world population in 1950, and it will be absorbed mostly by the less developed regions, whose population is projected to rise from 5.4 billion in 2007 to 7.9 billion in 2050. In contrast, the population of the more developed regions is expected to remain largely unchanged at 1.2 billion and would have declined were it not for the projected net migration from developing to developed countries, which is expected to average 2.3 million persons annually. So if you think the world feels crowded now, just wait a few decades. In 1800, London was the world's largest city with 1 million people. By 1960, there were 111 cities with more than 1 million people. By 1995, there were 280, and today there are over 300, according to UN Population Fund statistics. The number of megacities with 10 million or more inhabitants in the world has climbed from 5 in 1975 to 14 in 1995 and is expected to reach 26 cities by 2015, according to the UN. Needless to say, These exploding populations are rapidly overwhelming infrastructure in these megacities. 19 million people in Mumbai alone, as well as driving loss of arable land, deforestation, overfishing, water shortages, and air and water pollution. In 2007, the United Nations Population Fund's executive director, Thuraya Ahmed Obaid, issued a report stating that in 2008, more than half of humanity will be living in cities, and we are not ready for them. The Associated Press reported from London, June 27, 2007, that by 2030, the number of city dwellers is expected to climb to 5 billion. Obaid said smaller cities will absorb the bulk of urban growth. We're focusing on the megacities when the data tell us most of the movement will be coming to smaller cities of 500,000 or more, which often lack the water and energy resources and governing institutions to deal with rising migrant populations. This growth has come on so big, so fast, that Michael V. Hayden, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, stated that his analysts now believe the most worrying trend in the world is not terrorism, but demographics. Today there are 6.7 billion people sharing the planet, said General Hayden in a speech at Kansas State University, April 30, 2008. By mid-century, the best estimates point to a world population of more than 9 billion. That's a 40 to 45% increase, striking enough. But most of that growth is almost certain to occur in countries least able to sustain it. And that will create a situation that will likely fuel instability and extremism. Not just in those areas, but beyond them as well. There are many poor, fragile states where governance is actually difficult today, where populations will grow rapidly. Afghanistan, Liberia, Niger, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Among that group, the population is expected to triple by mid-century. The number of people in Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Yemen is likely to more than double. Furthermore, just beyond the raw numbers, all those countries will therefore have, as a result of this, a large concentration of young people. If their basic freedoms and basic needs, food, housing, education, employment, are not met, they could be easily attracted to violence, civil unrest, and extremism. This is what I mean by crowded. What about flat? When I wrote that the world is flat, I wasn't suggesting, of course, that it was getting physically flat or that we were all becoming economically equal. What I argued was that a combination of technological, market, and geopolitical events at the end of the 20th century had leveled the global economic playing field in a way that was enabling more people than ever, from more places than ever, to take part in the global economy, and, in the best of cases, to enter the middle class. This flattening was a product of several factors. The first was the invention and proliferation of the personal computer, which enabled individuals, to become authors of their own content in digital form. For the first time in history, individuals could create words, data, spreadsheets, photos, designs, videos, drawings, and music on their own PCs in the form of bits and bytes. Once an individual's content was in digital form, it could be shaped in many more ways and distributed to many more places. Another big flattener was the emergence of the Internet, the World Wide Web, and the web browser, a set of tools that enabled individuals to send their digital content anywhere in the world virtually for free and to easily display or access that content via web pages. The third flattener was a quiet revolution in software and transmission protocols, which I call the workflow revolution because of how it made everyone's computer and software interoperable, thus enabling work to flow farther and faster through internal company networks, the Internet, and the World Wide Web. Suddenly, so many more people could work together on so many different things. So Boeing could hire airplane designers in Moscow and integrate them with airplane builders in Wichita, and Dell could design computers in Austin and Taiwan and have them built in China and Ireland and serviced by technicians in India. The big geopolitical flattener was the collapse of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall. The demise of the Soviet Union and its Iron Curtain was like the elimination of a huge physical and political roadblock on the global economic playing field. In the wake of that collapse, market economics became the norm in virtually every country in the world, and even the likes of Cuba and North Korea began to dabble in capitalism. Put all these flatteners together, and what you have is a much more seamless, unobstructed global marketplace. In this global agora, millions and millions of new consumers and producers were able to buy or sell their goods and services as individuals or companies, and were able to collaborate with more people in more places on more things with greater ease for less money than ever before. That is what I meant by a flat world. The good news is that the end of communism and the flattening of the world helped to lift 200 million people out of abject poverty in the 1980s and 1990s in China and India alone, according to the International Monetary Fund, and moved tens of millions more higher up the economic ladder into the middle class. But as they've come out of poverty, which usually is associated with a rural and agricultural way of life, these several hundred million new players have begun earning wages that enabled them to consume more things and produce more things. And all these consumers walked onto the global economic playing field with their own versions of the American dream: a car, a house, an air conditioner, a cell phone, a microwave, a toaster, a computer, and an iPod, creating a huge new demand for things, all of which devour lots of energy, natural resources, land, and water, and emit lots of climate-changing greenhouse gases from the time they are produced to when they are discarded. This, of course, is stoking an unprecedented competition for energy, minerals, water, and forest products, as rising and growing nations like Brazil, India, Russia, and China pursue comfort, prosperity, and economic security for more and more of their people. And we're just at the beginning. In the next 12 years alone, the world's population is expected to swell by roughly another billion people, and many of them will become new consumers and producers. When that happens, the law of large numbers starts to kick in. Everything starts to add up to huge, notes David Douglas, Vice President for Eco-Responsibility for Sun Microsystems. For instance, he asks, what if, once that newest billion are all here, we gave each of them a 60-watt incandescent light bulb? Each bulb doesn't weigh much, roughly 0.7 ounces with the packaging, but a billion of them together weigh around 20,000 metric tons, or about the same as 15,000 Priuses, said Douglas. Now let's turn them on. If they're all on at the same time, it'd be 60,000 megawatts. Luckily, they will only use their bulbs 4 hours per day, so we're down to 10,000 megawatts at any moment. Yikes. Looks like we'll still need 20 or so new 500-megawatt coal-burning power plants, just so the next billion people can turn a light on. What about hot? The broad scientific understanding today is that our planet is experiencing a warming trend, over and above natural and normal variations, that is almost certainly due to human activities associated with large-scale manufacturing. The process began in the late 1700s with the Industrial Revolution, when manual labor, horsepower, and water power began to be replaced by or enhanced by machines. This revolution, over time, shifted Britain, Europe, and eventually North America from largely agricultural and trading societies to manufacturing ones, relying on machinery and engines rather than tools and animals. The Industrial Revolution was at heart a revolution in the use of energy and power. Its beginning is usually dated to the advent of the steam engine, which was based on the conversion of chemical energy in wood or coal to thermal energy and then to mechanical work, primarily the powering of industrial machinery and steam locomotives. Coal eventually supplanted wood because, pound for pound, coal contains twice as much energy as wood, measured in BTUs or British thermal units per pound. And because its use helped to save what was left of the world's temperate forests. Coal was used to produce heat that went directly into industrial processes, including metallurgy, and to warm buildings, as well as to power steam engines. When crude oil came along in the mid-1800s, still a couple of decades before electricity, it was burned, in the form of kerosene, in lamps to make light, replacing whale oil. It was also used to provide heat for buildings and in manufacturing processes, and as a fuel for engines used in industry and propulsion. In short, one can say that the main forms in which humans need and use energy are for light, heat, mechanical work and motive power, and electricity, which can be used to provide any of the other three, as well as to do things that none of those three can do, such as electronic communications and information processing. Since the Industrial Revolution, all these energy functions have been powered primarily, but not exclusively, by fossil fuels that emit carbon dioxide, CO2. To put it another way, the Industrial Revolution gave a whole new prominence to what Rochelle Lefkowitz, president of Pro Media Communications and an energy buff, calls fuels from hell: coal, oil, and natural gas. All these fuels from hell come from underground, are exhaustible, and emit CO2 and other pollutants when they are burned for transportation, heating, and industrial use. These fuels are in contrast to what Lefkowitz calls fuels from heaven: wind, hydroelectric, tidal, biomass, and solar power. These all come from above ground, are endlessly renewable, and produce no harmful emissions. The early years of the 20th century also brought a transportation revolution with the invention of the internal combustion engine and its use to power cars and trucks. Gasoline-powered motor cars were invented in Germany in the late 19th century, but according to IdeaFinder.com, the first automobile to be produced in quantity was the 1901 curved-dash Oldsmobile, which was built in the United States by Ransom E. Olds. Modern automobile mass production and its use of the modern industrial assembly line is credited to Henry Ford of Detroit, Michigan, who had built his first gasoline-powered car in 1896. Ford began producing his Model T in 1908, and by 1927, when it was discontinued, over 18 million had rolled off the assembly line. The internal combustion engine transformed commerce, made crude oil hugely valuable for powering automobiles, and greatly increased demand for iron, steel, and rubber. A steam engine worked by external combustion, with coal, oil, or wood burning outside and creating the steam that actually powered the engine. The internal combustion engine created the combustion process internally, which was more efficient, required less fuel, and allowed for smaller engines and motors. Meanwhile, industrialization promoted urbanization, and urbanization eventually gave birth to suburbanization. This trend, which was repeated across America, nurtured the development of the American car culture, the building of a national highway system, and a mushrooming of suburbs around American cities, which rewove the fabric of American life. Many other developed and developing countries followed the American model with all its upsides and downsides. The result is that today we have suburbs and ribbons of highways that run in, out, and around not only America's major cities, but China's, India's, and South America's as well. And as these urban areas attract more people, the sprawl extends in every direction. And why not? All the coal, oil, and natural gas inputs for this new economic model seemed relatively cheap, relatively inexhaustible, and relatively harmless, or at least relatively easy to clean up afterward. So there wasn't much to stop the juggernaut of more people and more development and more concrete and more buildings and more cars and more coal, oil, and gas needed to build and power them. Summing it all up, Andy Karsner, the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, once said to me, "We built a really inefficient environment with the greatest efficiency ever known to man." After the publication of books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962, people became more aware of the toxic effects of pesticides. This early environmental awareness gradually expanded to embrace concerns about urban air pollution, industrial waste emitted into lakes and rivers, and the rapidly increasing loss of green spaces due to urban sprawl. In America, these concerns set in motion an environmental movement, which eventually produced legislation designed to protect or restore clean air and clean water, and to stem the worst water pollution, toxic waste dumping, smog, ozone depletion, acid rain, and roadside litter. Building on a century of wilderness conservation dating back to the naturalist John Muir, the modern environmental movement also brought about passage of the Endangered Species Act and other conservation legislation to safeguard America's natural wonders and biodiversity. But there was no time to rest. Beginning in the second half of the 20th century, a scientific understanding began to emerge that an excessive accumulation of largely invisible pollutants, called greenhouse gases, was affecting the climate. The buildup of these greenhouse gases had been underway since the start of the Industrial Revolution in a place we could not see and in a form we could not touch or smell. These greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, emitted from human, industrial, residential, and transportation sources, were not piling up along roadsides or in rivers, in cans or empty bottles, but rather above our heads, in the Earth's atmosphere. If the Earth's atmosphere was like a blanket that helped to regulate the planet's temperature, the CO2 buildup was having the effect of thickening that blanket and making the globe warmer. To visualize this process, the California Institute of Technology energy chemist Nate Lewis offers the following analogy. Imagine you are driving in your car, and every mile you drive, you throw a pound of trash out your window. And everyone else on the freeway in their cars and trucks is doing the exact same thing. And people driving Hummers are throwing two bags out at a time, one out the driver's side window and one out the passenger side window. How would you feel? Not so good. Well, that is exactly what we are doing. You just can't see it. Only what we are throwing out is a pound of CO2, That's what goes into the atmosphere, on average, every mile we drive. Those bags of CO2 from our cars float up and stay in the atmosphere, along with bags of CO2 from power plants burning coal, oil, and gas, and bags of CO2 released from the burning and clearing of forests, which releases all the carbon stored in trees, plants, and soil. In fact, many people don't realize that deforestation in places like Indonesia and Brazil is responsible for more CO2 than all the world's cars, trucks, planes, ships, and trains combined. That is, about 20% of all global emissions. And when we're not tossing bags of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we're throwing up other greenhouse gases, like methane, CH4, released from rice farming, petroleum drilling, coal mining, animal defecation, solid waste landfill sites, and, yes, even from cattle belching. Cattle belching? That's right. The striking thing about greenhouse gases is the diversity of sources that emit them. A herd of cattle belching can be worse than a highway full of Hummers. Livestock gas is very high in methane, which, like CO2, is colorless and odorless. And like CO2, methane is one of those greenhouse gases that, once released into the atmosphere, also absorb heat radiating from the Earth's surface. Molecule for molecule, methane's heat-trapping power in the atmosphere is 21 times stronger than carbon dioxide, the most abundant greenhouse gas, reported Science World, January 21, 2002. With 1.3 billion cows belching almost constantly around the world, 100 million in the United States alone, it's no surprise that methane released by livestock is one of the chief global sources of the gas, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. It's part of their normal digestion process, says Tom Wirth of the EPA. When they chew their cud, they regurgitate, spit up, some food to re-chew it, and all this gas comes out. The average cow expels 600 liters of methane a day, climate researchers report. What is the precise scientific relationship between these expanded greenhouse gas emissions and global warming? Experts at the Pew Center on Climate Change offer a handy summary in their report, Climate Change 101. Global average temperatures, notes the Pew study, have experienced natural shifts throughout human history. For example, the climate of the Northern Hemisphere varied from a relatively warm period between the 11th and 15th centuries to a period of cooler temperatures between the 17th century and the middle of the 19th century. However, scientists studying the rapid rise in global temperatures during the late 20th century say that natural variability cannot account for what is happening now. The new factor is the human factor. Our vastly increased emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from the burning of fossil fuels such as coal and oil, as well as from deforestation, large-scale cattle grazing, agriculture, and industrialization. Scientists refer to what has been happening in the Earth's atmosphere over the past century as the enhanced greenhouse effect, notes the Pew study. By pumping man-made greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, humans are altering the process by which naturally occurring greenhouse gases, because of their unique molecular structure, trap the sun's heat near the Earth's surface before that heat radiates back into space. The greenhouse effect keeps the Earth warm and habitable. Without it, the Earth's surface would be about 60 degrees Fahrenheit colder on average. Since the average temperature of the Earth is about 45 degrees Fahrenheit, the natural greenhouse effect is clearly a good thing. But the enhanced greenhouse effect means even more of the sun's heat is trapped, causing global temperatures to rise. among the many scientific studies providing clear evidence that an enhanced greenhouse effect is underway was a 2005 report from NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Using satellites, data from buoys, and computer models to study the Earth's oceans, scientists concluded that more energy is being absorbed from the sun than is emitted back to space, throwing the Earth's energy out of balance and warming the globe. A variety of data reinforces this conclusion. The composition of the Earth's atmosphere has been relatively unchanged for 20 million years, noted Caltech's Nate Lewis, but in the last 100 years, we have begun to dramatically transform that atmosphere and change the heat balance between the Earth and the Sun in ways that could profoundly affect the habitats of every plant, animal, and human on this planet. On the eve of the Industrial Revolution, according to ice core samples that have trapped air bubbles from previous eras and can provide us a snapshot of climate conditions going back thousands of years, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere stood at roughly 280 parts per million by volume, and it had been stable around that level for about 10,000 years before that, Lewis added. It started to surge in the 1950s, tracking the broad global surge in energy consumption led by the Western industrial powers after World War II. Despite all the talk about the need to mitigate climate change, the rate at which we humans are pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is still accelerating. In 2007, the CO2 level in the atmosphere stood at 384 parts per million by volume and appeared to be climbing at a rate of 2 parts per million a year. The general agreement among climate experts is that the Earth has already warmed on average by 0.8 degrees Celsius, 1.44 degrees Fahrenheit, above its level in 1750, with the most rapid rise occurring since 1970. Changes over the different continents and altitudes have been much greater than just these averages. A 1 degree change in the global average temperature may not sound like much, but it is telling you something is amiss with the state of the climate, just as small changes in your body temperature tell you that something is amiss with your body. Your body temperature is normally 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and when it goes up just a few degrees to 102 Fahrenheit, it is a big deal. It tells you something is wrong, says John Holdren, who is professor of environmental policy at Harvard, director of the Woods Hole Research Center, and the former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The same is true with changes in the global average surface temperature. From our ice core samples, Holdren explained, we know that the difference in global average temperature between an ice age and an interglacial period like we are in now, that is, the difference between the Earth being an ice ball and being very comfortable for human development and agriculture, is a mere 5 to 6 degrees Celsius. So a small difference in that global average temperature can lead to very big changes, which is why this 0.8 degrees Celsius rise is telling us, as Al Gore likes to say, that planet Earth has a fever. According to the World Meteorological Organization, the 10 hottest years since thermometer records became available in 1860 all occurred between 1995 and 2005. CNN founder Ted Turner is not a scientist, but in his own blunt way, he summed up what it means when the world gets hot, flat, and crowded. We're too many people. That's why we have global warming, he said in an interview with Charlie Rose, April 2, 2008. Too many people are using too much stuff. As I indicated, though, the story of the energy climate era doesn't stop with the perfect storm of hot, flat, and crowded. The convergence of global warming, global flattening, and global crowding is driving those five big problems: energy supply and demand, petro-dictatorship, climate change, energy poverty, and biodiversity loss, well past their tipping points into new realms we've never seen before, as a planet or as a species. Here is a brief look at each one. Energy and natural resources, supply and demand. From the beginning of the Industrial Revolution right up to the late 20th century, most Americans and most people around the world lived under the happy illusion that the fossil fuels we were using to generate mechanical power, transportation power, building heat, cooking heat, industrial processes, and electricity were largely inexhaustible, inexpensive, politically benign, and, though nasty if you lived in Newcastle, climatically benign as well. As we enter the energy-climate era, that changes. We now understand that these fossil fuels are exhaustible, increasingly expensive, and politically, ecologically, and climatically toxic. That's the line we've crossed. What changed? The simple answer is that flat meant crowded. So many more people were suddenly able to improve their standards of living so much faster. And when the crowding of the world and the flattening of the world converged around the year 2000, the world went onto a track where global demand for energy, natural resources, and food all started to grow at a much accelerated pace, as the Western industrialized countries still consumed considerable amounts of energy and natural resources, and big emerging countries got to join them at the middle-class dinner table. If you want to have a graphic image of what is happening, you couldn't do better than the one offered by Richard Reichels from the Electric Power Research Institute. It's as if the world were a bathtub that America and other developed countries, with their own growth, filled to the brim, he told me. And then along came India and China and others, and they turned on the shower. Now, all this demand is just overflowing onto the bathroom floor. The energy economist Philip K. Verliger, Jr. notes that global energy consumption grew by 5% per year from 1951 to 1970. This rapid growth occurred simultaneously with the economic reconstruction in Europe and Japan after World War II, as well as the post-war growth in the United States, Verliger wrote in The International Economy, September 22, 2007. History may well repeat from 2001 to 2020 as China, India, and other countries move from developing to developed nations. Consumption can be expected to increase at a pace close to the rate of the economic growth in these nations, just as it did in Europe, Japan, and the United States following the Second World War. While these countries may, through efficiency measures, be able to produce more GDP growth with less energy, the fact is they are now involved in building massive amounts of new infrastructure, and that infrastructure is energy intensive, said Verliger. That is why Royal Dutch Shell's energy scenario team predicts in its 2008 report that global consumption of all forms of energy will at least double between now and 2050 because of the combination of population growth and greater wealth driven by the globalization of markets. That is what's new about the forces propelling the energy-climate era. They are demand-driven, as so many more people suddenly are, can, or will be living a middle-class lifestyle. The pivotal year that told us we were in a new era in terms of global energy supply and demand was 2004, says Larry Goldstein, an oil expert at the Energy Policy Research Foundation. What happened in 2004 was the world's first demand-led energy shock. Here's what he means. In 1973, 1980, and 1990, we saw sudden oil price spikes because of wars and revolution in the Middle East, which sharply limited the supply of oil. What happened in 2004, said Goldstein, was a price shock that was simply the product of long-term trends that pushed demand well ahead of supply, spurred in large part by a sudden leap in demand from China. Historically, outside of wars, whenever the crude oil market got tight, said Goldstein, shortages could be eased either by spare usable crude oil capacity, spare refining capacity, or spare discretionary oil product inventories. These three reserves were the shock absorbers for the world oil market. And year after year, as oil demand continued to increase at about 1% a year, these shock absorbers would absorb that gradual increase and ensure that prices went up only gradually until 2004. Two things happened that year. All the shock absorbers, all that spare crude, product, and refining capacity disappeared, and demand for energy took a great leap forward due to China's growth. At the start of 2004, the International Energy Agency predicted that global demand for crude oil would grow by 1.5 million barrels a day that year, said Goldstein. Instead, it grew by 3 million barrels a day, and demand in China alone grew by over 1 million barrels a day, he said. And because all three of the traditional shock absorbers were gone, that extra demand could not be cushioned. Why not? Normally, high prices would prompt more investment, more drilling, and more oil. It has been slow to happen this time around, though, for several reasons, said Goldstein. First, there was a broad shortage of equipment in the oil industry, from skilled petroleum engineers to drilling rigs to tankers, to expand production. Second, countries like Russia began retroactively changing the drilling rules in their fields, squeezing out foreign producers in order to pump more oil themselves. What this did was discourage more professional and experienced global oil companies from operating there, and this, in turn, reduced production. Finally, America and other Western nations continued to limit the amount of acreage they were ready to offer for oil drilling for conservation reasons. So not only did the market tip in 2004, but it kept tipping and tipping and tipping, which is why prices skyrocketed by 2008 as demand continued to rise. Soaring oil and gas prices, though, are only one of the things that happen when global flattening meets global crowding. What else happens? You get a world in which there are still about 2.4 billion people living on $2 a day or less, according to the World Bank, but in which millions of them are striving and succeeding to get on board the Flat World platform, which creates enormous new demand for other natural resources, a blessing for world stability, but a challenge for ecology and climate. Everything today is in shortage. Steel, bauxite, construction equipment, engineers, contractors, ships, said Klaus Kleinfeld, president of Alcoa, the global aluminum manufacturer. You run into bottlenecks now everywhere you turn. Take aluminum, he explained. First of all, there are more people on the planet every day, and, particularly in the developing world, more of them are moving to urban areas where they live in high-rise buildings, drive cars or motor scooters, ride buses, fly on airplanes, and start to drink Coke from cans. All of that increases global demand for aluminum. Companies like Alcoa then go out and try to acquire more bauxite. That requires more mines and smelters, and that requires more ships and more steel and more energy, And that requires more engineers and more contractors. When you try to do every one of those things today, build a new ship, build a new smelter, hire a global contracting firm, he said, everyone tells you the same thing.